Happy Easter, happy Ostara, and joyous spring. So I believe it is fair to say that a lot of people are inclined to dismiss the myths of the sort we just heard as primitive and ignorant, superstitious explanations from people living in the past who just didn't know any better. And thank you to our three storytellers. The word myth carries the connotation that it is a story based in falsehoods and ignorance. It also carries a connotation of time. Myths are what historical people did. English provides us with lots of other options. So when we're choosing to use the word myth, we are in fact making a judgment. Why do we do that? Where does it come from? I see two sources that are at work on us when we think about myth. One of them on the next slide is Christianity. Christianity operates in a binary. Things are true or things are false. Things come from God in heaven or from Satan in hell. Christianity was and is very invested in dismissing and demonizing ideas from outside themselves and stories that come from outside themselves. By Christianity's reckoning, the explanation for the origins of the universe in the book of Genesis is factual, but any other explanation for the origins of the universe is mythical falsehood. Now granted, I'm generalizing here. Not everyone who identifies as Christian, including Christian UUs, sees Genesis as factual. But for the majority of Christians globally, that is probably a fair statement. And whether we're Christian or not, we have been impacted by Christianity's tendency to see things in a binary, true or false. The other thing that's at work on our minds about myths comes from the Enlightenment on the next slide. So what we have here is a chart from the 19th century that maps out global history. And you can't see it very well, but in the very center, that big pink, that's Britain divided by province down to the county, and China is a tiny stream down at the bottom. Right? So you can tell this is a very white European perception of what history is. And this is a legacy of the Enlightenment, where white modern Europeans consider themselves the pinnacle, the top of reason and rationality. And everyone else, whether in a different place or in a different time period, they were grounded in superstition, or at least partial superstition, unlike modern Europeans. And this is where, in fact, the term Dark Ages comes from. The Enlightenment invented the Dark Ages to make themselves more rational and reasonable, and the people behind them more superstitious. The Enlightenment is also they're also the folks who invented the idea that philosophy is based on reason and religion is not, and they conveniently sidestepped all of the ancient philosophers and who had supernatural elements, right? They just lifted out the reason part and sidestepped the supernatural part because they wanted that part of history to be part of their heritage. Enlightenment thinking has left a legacy in Western cultures like ours that has made us a bit, I think the word would be arrogant about our own time period in which we're living, that we're defined by progress and rationalism, and it gives us a tendency to see people of the historical past as more superstitious, more gullible, pre-scientific. And again, that's a generalization. We don't always do this, but it is part of our culture. It is a legacy of the Enlightenment that is active on our thinking. If you could head to the next slide, Brenda. Thank you. Well, as we've all lived through the Trump era and its legacy, and we've all come to see, however, that being part of the modern world does not mean we're fully grounded in reason and tangible evidence and scientific thinking. Not only does a conspiracy theory as bizarre as QAnon exist, it has widespread support. Someone even got elected to Congress from that perspective. So we don't seem to have a right to a great deal of smugness that those of us in the modern contemporary world are all about applying our reason and our critical thinking, while those poor historical people struggled in their superstition and magical and mythical thinking. Our society has all sorts of truth claims in it, ranging from the super rational to the super non-rational and everything in between. So what might be much fairer to say is that sometimes some people prefer to, or maybe they need to, understand reality in ways that are partly or exclusively based on emotions and instinct and imagination, and not just our brains. I don't know of any culture at any point in time that did not have multiple ways of explaining reality in ways that sometimes use tangible or intangible evidence, reason and emotion, instinct and imagination, and various combinations of those things. We all gravitate towards different ways to use or combine reason, experience, emotion, instinct, imagination. And in fact, this is reflected in our six sources. Our six sources name all of those things as what you use, draw our inspiration and theologies from. So what this all might be pointing to is a universal human experience, that no matter the when or the where, there have always been a plurality of ways to explain the fundamental questions of life and reality. Even in the places where the myths we heard today from our storytellers, even in those places where they were in circulation, they were approached in more than one way. And Brenda has some quotes for us on the next slide. We have lots of textual and archaeological evidence to suggest that there were lots of people who took the myths we heard today in a very literal way, that they took them as a statement of factual truth and faith. We also have evidence that people rejected them. So here are some quotes from a number of ancient Greek thinkers that reflect perspectives other than a literal interpretation. From Aristophanes, "Shrines, shrines, surely you don't believe in the gods. Where's your argument? Where's your proof? As to the gods, I have no means of knowing either that they exist or do not exist. For many are the obstacles that impede knowledge, both the obscurity of the question and the shortness of human life." That comes from Pythagoras. From Epicurus, "Men believing in myths will always fear something terrible. Everlasting punishment is certain or probable. Men base all these fears not on mature opinions, but on irrational fancies, so that they are more disturbed by fear of the unknown than by facing facts. Peace of mind lies in being delivered from all of these fears." And a fourth one from Xenophanes, Ethiopians say that their gods are snub-nosed and black, while the Thracians say that theirs are pale and red-haired. But if cattle and horses and lions had hands, or could paint with their hands and create works such as men do, horses like horses and cattle like cattle also would depict the gods' shapes and make their bodies of such a sort as the form they themselves have. So these Greeks are saying that we can't know if the gods and goddesses exist, or even if they do, they can't help us, or that there is a divine realm, but Greeks are not understanding it properly. That's what Xenophanes is saying. It may not be entirely reflected in the quote. He believed that there was a divine entity, but that it was not human-like, and that Greeks were making a big mistake in anthropomorphizing it and giving it human characteristics. And while I couldn't find a quote about it, I'm confident that there were also others who approached Greek myths as a form of cultural heritage that was worth sharing and passing on. For some of them, maybe it was a means of entertainment. It could be a source of wisdom and insight into the universal human experience. What I'm getting at is a story doesn't have to be 100% literal and true to have value for us. The ancient Greeks approached their own stories from a variety of perspectives. So here's what I'm going to invite all of us to consider today. Just as the ancient Greeks did, we have options beyond embracing myths wholeheartedly and treating them like truth with a capital T, or mocking them as superstitious nonsense that primitive foolish people believed. I'm going to suggest that myths have something they can offer us beyond the literal. So the three myths our storytellers shared today are capturing and expressing the mystery and the wonder of nature, a wonder that human beings have witnessed every spring since human beings began. And even in tropical parts of the world that don't have four seasons in the same way we do, the ending of the dry season still has the same equivalent and the same sense of wonder. So that sense of natural wonder and mystery, this is something our human ancestors can offer us through their mythic stories about spring. It seems fair to say that our ancestors had a greater sense of natural wonder than we do. And why might that be? Well, it's not because we're smarter and we've replaced all of their fairy tales with science. The greater factor is that those of us in the modern world have a lifestyle much less connected to nature. We're far less dependent on the seasons than our ancestors were. If you could head to the next slide, Brenda. Far fewer of us are engaged in agriculture than was true of our ancestors. So the slide in the bottom right is the percentage of the American workforce involved in agriculture. On the one side, in 1840, so we're only talking about less than two centuries ago, around 70% of the workforce was involved in agriculture. Now we're down to about 3 or 4%. Far more of us are urban than was true of the past. We spend far more of our lives in artificial environments than people of the past as well. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, the average American spends 93% of their life indoors. And of that 93%, 87% is in buildings and another 6% in transportation, which means we only spend about 7% of our lives outdoors and in a natural environment. So think of it this way. We spend almost as much time in transportation as we do in nature and outdoors. And on top of all of those differences between our society and ancient peoples, for us, winter is a whole lot less scary and lethal than it was for people in the past. And while it's sadly not true for everyone, many of us in the modern world are more food and energy secure than were people of the past. Our artificial environments are better built. We have greater access to energy. And we have the ability to store more food and move at greater distances than was true of the past. So for us, the arrival of spring does not carry the same level of relief and the same connotation of safety as it once did. One more blizzard, or one late season blizzard for us, is inconvenient. It may make us sad, but it probably isn't going to mean that we run out of food or we freeze to death. But that might have been true in the past. I'm ready for the next slide, Brenda. So this is where I see the gift of these three myths. The gift is not in the literal descriptions of what a bull monster did, or how a goddess was returned from the underworld, or how a god got put back together again. The gift is the enchantment and wonder and gratitude that people felt in the natural miracle of the earth reviving and resurrecting itself and transforming winter into spring. From dormancy and hibernation and cold came resurrection, renewal, new life, warmth. The arrival of spring did much more than just buoy spirits. It literally provided the promise of survival. And this is why the defeat of Neon and the Chinese New Year has remained the most important Chinese holiday to this day. And it's not because Neon is literally real, but because spring is wondrous and glorious and worth celebrating. And this is why the worship of Persephone and Demeter and Osiris was so popular in Roman Egypt. People believed that their stories revealed the secrets and power of life and immortality and enabled our survival. So let's see if all of us can use these myths as a bridge of metaphor to recapture some of the wonder our ancestors had about spring and the revival of the earth. I invite all of us to do our best to dial down our rational and intellectual side a bit and dial up our instinctual and emotional and imaginative connections with spring and nature. So in a moment, Brenda, or maybe Bill, I'm not sure where we're launching it from, are going to start a YouTube video that has images of spring. It's about 3.5 minutes long. And Brad is going to play some low tempo music while the video plays. And I invite all of us to enjoy this audio and visual meditation of spring. May it nourish our wonder and gratitude for the natural miracles of spring.